Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, what we're learning about the insurrection on January 6th and questions that remain. More than a week after the attack on the U.S. Capitol, a fuller picture is emerging of what happened that day. We now know dozens of suspected white supremacists on the FBI's terror watch list were in D.C. As arrests begin, federal law enforcement officials say some of those involved in the attack had plans to capture and assassinate elected officials. At the same time, what government agencies knew and why they did not ramp up security is being investigated. My guest, Mary McCord, is an expert on these extremist groups and armed militias. She's legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown University. I spoke with her Friday morning. Mary, you did interviews before January 6th, the day of the insurrection. You were warning right then of violence in D.C. You saw it coming. If people like you saw it coming, what are we learning about what those folks at the FBI, other security agencies, what did they know?
Yes, so a lot of researchers with whom I work and others, you know, have provided information to law enforcement and did so prior to January 6th. Information that indicated that certainly some of the people that were planning to come to Washington, D.C. on January 6th were planning to engage in acts of violence. Not everyone, but some of the more extreme of those. There was planning online to encircle the Capitol and occupy it and to prevent that vote by whatever means necessary. I also feel confident that law enforcement, through its own resources, probably was aware of this. So to me, I don't think it was an issue of them not having the information. It was a question of what they did with it. And I do think that the Metropolitan Police Department in D.C. was, you know, very prepared for potential violence on the streets and things they had faced in previous occasions, right, in December and in November when some people had come and engaged in acts of violence. So what really puzzles me is the reaction of the Capitol Police. And I think that that will be the subject of some investigation, obviously, as it should be. I can only speculate, but I can offer a few bits of speculation. The Capitol Police, even though they're very used to demonstrations on Capitol grounds, they are much more used to demonstrators who are basically law-abiding or are engaged in civil disobedience with an intent to be arrested, but basically in an entirely peaceful way. And so they are not as accustomed to engaging in sort of actual physical confrontations and violent confrontations with protesters the way, for example, the Metropolitan Police Department is. So I think in some ways that might have like affected their approach. But I think you also have to consider that they also might have thought this is where the inherent bias comes in, a group of almost entirely white people. White people who claim that they're patriots. There are Republicans inside the Capitol as well as Democrats, and these people are aligned with those Republicans. And I think that the police may have just made an assumption that this crowd wouldn't be violent, which is an assumption I think that, you know, has internally baked into it some inherent biases that are reflected across our society and something, you know, we've become more and more aware of this year.
What about the FBI's Washington field office? Surely they were seeing and interpreting the same kind of information you were.
Yes, I think that's right. And, you know, there were some conflicting statements coming out of that office. I saw a statement early on that they weren't aware of any of these kinds of plans for violence, which I didn't find that credible at all. Later, it seems like that was walked back and they gave an indication that they were aware of those things. What I don't know is what was the planning and organization between the FBI, Washington Field Office, Metropolitan Police Department, Capitol Police, and the many other law enforcement agencies that have jurisdiction in Washington. You know, it's an interesting place, and it's unlike any other place because there are so many different law enforcement agencies with overlapping jurisdictions. And normally, for something like that day, when we knew there were going to be multiple rallies, there would have been multiple meetings, coordinated meetings in advance, just like we're seeing in advance of the inauguration, to plan for how the agencies can work together, backstop each other, provide support, etc. There would have also been meetings with neighboring jurisdictions like Arlington and Alexandria and Montgomery County and things like that, so that if neighboring police forces were necessary, they could have come. So that's where I think we need an investigation to figure out, did the law enforcement assess the intelligence as not credible? Did they just find it credible and not take adequate measures? Were there law enforcement that were urging Capitol Police to do more and they declined? I just don't know. I think it is also worth mentioning that particularly in the aftermath of the racial justice demonstrations throughout the summer and rightful criticisms of heavy-handed police techniques, it's appropriate to go into a demonstration with soft policing rather than hard policing. I mean, I think we generally want to see that. So that might have also impacted why the Capitol Police decided, you know, to have just, you know, their normal uniforms as opposed to riot gear and have smaller barriers as opposed to large fencing. The problem with this is, of course, this demonstration, you know, lost its First Amendment status and became a violent mob very, very quickly. And what the Capitol Police didn't have was then that backup of hard policing when that became necessary. So I don't want us to over-pivot so much that we discourage soft policing for demonstrations, because I think that's part of what the summer is about. Like, police ought to be respecting and fostering First Amendment rights with soft policing. But you've got to be prepared if the crowd turns violent.
The other question is about the Department of Homeland Security itself saying to NPR that they didn't produce any threat assessment about the possibility of violence on January 6th. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I find that just almost unfathomable. I mean, we know that the intelligence and analysis unit of DHS has really been decimated under this administration. And I think they've, you know, been what's left of it, if anything, has been pretty beaten down by the administration, by directions from above that essentially tells them that white supremacist violence is not a problem in the U.S., that instead it's Antifa violence that is a problem. And so whether the people that remain in that office just, you know, what I don't know is, did they try to do an assessment that then they were thwarted in putting out, or did they just give up because they just didn't think it would go anywhere? I don't know. Same with the FBI. Like, normally there would be intelligence assessments, and I assume there were, and we've now heard that there were some coming from some of the offices raising some of the threats. We've also heard, or I've seen reporting, I haven't seen the assessment itself, we've seen reporting that it also expressed a number of cautions about not treading on First Amendment rights. And again, I think it's appropriate that law enforcement be concerned about not treading on First Amendment rights, but not so expansively that then they forego public safety for that. And so I think we need to think about the training we've had for our law enforcement about the First Amendment and where the boundaries of that are, because threats are not protected First Amendment, and incitement to imminent lawless activity is not protected by the First Amendment.
Had the president made some statement as the protesters were moving toward the Capitol, could it have made a difference?
You know, the president had done so much damage already by building up for this moment with the lies about the election being stolen, the encouragement of his most extreme supporters to stop the steal, to never concede, to fight like hell. You know, I do think it would have helped if he could have said something, you know, as things were getting started, because with all the cell phones out there, somebody would have gotten word of what he said. But to a certain extent, it was already too late, right? Because he had stoked them up just an hour before that when he gave his speech saying things like fight like hell. really just everything other than saying, march down, storm the Capitol, and stop the vote. I mean, he just, you know, he didn't say those words, but he didn't have to. So I think, though, you know, if he had said, call it off, I never intended this violence, I do think some would have still gone in, but it might not have been as bad as it was. You know, so much he had done had led to this moment, and even when he did make statements, they were really, we love you, don't be violent. I mean, that you can't, that doesn't work.
Did you agree with the House's vote to impeach this president for the second time?
I do agree with that. I mean, what I think we saw was an abuse of power and an incitement to insurrection. And, you know, in fact, I've written something recently about his conduct warrants a criminal investigation into whether he committed the crime of incitement to insurrection. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that as a policy matter or a strategic matter that a criminal prosecution is warranted, but certainly an investigation into what he knew about the plans for violence, how that matches up with the statements he made and the encouragement of his supporters. You know, what briefings did he get? What social media was he consuming before he said things like never concede, fight like hell, stop the seal? You know, what connections does he or his inner circle have with people who might have been involved in organizing this? You know, and you can get that through phone records and other types of records. And that's warranted for accountability. And I think the House, there was enough on the record that you would need much more in order to meet the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury of 12 in trial. You'd want much more. But for the House, in terms of the abuse of power that was quite obvious from just what is apparent, you know, publicly to everyone, was well warranted to take the action that it did. And the accountability here is what I think is so important, Diane, because, you know, he could try to run for president again. But if you are found to have engaged in insurrection, under the Constitution, you're barred from holding federal office again. And I think that's very, very important here. That could have been accomplished potentially by invoking the 25th Amendment, with which Vice President Pence has declined to do. It could be accomplished through impeachment and conviction. It could be accomplished through a criminal liability. And it could potentially be accomplished through other methods directly under the 14th Amendment, Section 3, which is where that prohibition comes from.
What did you make of the fact that we learned after the fact that visitors had actually been allowed into the Capitol within days of the insurrection, when the rule had been laid down that there would be no visitors allowed?
I think that's another thing that needs to be investigated, particularly with respect to, you know, in multiple ways. The people, to the extent those people were part of the insurrection on January 6th, obviously that's important information to be known in their prosecutions. Because right now, of course, the U.S. Attorney's Office appropriately and the FBI is trying to make quick arrests on whatever charges are obvious from the video evidence, but they can add additional charges. And as they find out if there was planned, And if those were basically reconnaissance visits, that could really, you know, provide the support for more serious charges against those people. But I think it's also important to know what role, if any, what knowledge, if any, the Congress people who sponsored those visits played in this. It could be innocent. It could be not. We do know that there are some, you know, House members who are actually QAnon supporters, or certainly haven't denounced them and have at times, you know, accepted the support of QAnon. And that's extremely troublesome, because that is the source of so many of the conspiracy theories that led to the violence.
In a letter to the acting House and Senate Sergeant at Arms and U.S. Capitol Police, the lawmakers, this is from the New York Times, many of whom served in the military and said they were trained to recognize suspicious activity, demanded answers about what they described as an extremely high number of outside groups led into the Capitol on January 5th at a time when most tours were restricted because of the coronavirus. So, really, you've got to wonder about that.
that should be the subject of investigation. You know, we've even seen since then objections by some legislators to public safety measures that have been instituted since the insurrection. So, you know, conduct after the fact is also can be probative of intent before the fact. And those things are all building blocks that people doing an investigation will have to be looking at.
Do we know who it was, what groups made up this group of insurrectionists?
I mean, we certainly have identified a number of different groups, and I really am hesitant and don't want to actually name them on public radio just because I don't want to give them any more publicity, which they crave and they use for their own recruitment and merchandising and fundraising. But I can describe generally what kind of categories they're in, right? So we had conspiracy theorists, and I have mentioned the primary conspirators. We had, you know, people who adhere to and traffic in, and by traffic in, I mean traffic in online as well as out at public demonstrations, traffic in conspiracy theories. We also had just a very extreme sort of right-wing white nationalists, white supremacists, those who have been agitating for, you know, a white ethno-state for some time now. And we had unlawful private militias who were very involved in the organizing organizing themselves to go. We have yet to see whether there's any sort of top structural organization that brought all these groups together, other than the fact that they all knew about each other's plans to go, all were conspiring to also go and knew they would join up with each other once they got there. But these unlawful militias were very involved in that. Many of them sent contingents. Some we've been able to identify through video. Some were actually dressed like in full military kits. They weren't as obvious as they sometimes are because Washington, D.C. is not an open carry jurisdiction. And even for concealed carry weapons, you have to have a Washington, D.C. permit, not a permit from another state. So these groups, we know from their online planning, they were aware of that. And some were talking about, nevertheless, smuggling concealed firearms in under, you know, their coats and things like that. And we know some arrests have been made for firearms, but they weren't able to march in with AR-15s like we've seen in other jurisdictions that are open carry jurisdictions, even though that activity is illegal in other states as well. In addition, we had like the violent street gangs, the types that have come to D.C. and other states before and ostensibly to demonstrate, but really they go out and they look for fights. They pick physical fights with people that they think are Antifa out on the streets. We had several of those. But also intermixed in this, and I think this is partly why it was such a dangerous day, were people who I think probably came intending to exercise First Amendment rights because of an honestly held belief that there was some election fraud. Now, I would say they were vulnerable to the lies and disinformation put out by the president and others, but that doesn't mean that some of them didn't honestly hold that belief. And they probably had no intent to commit an insurrection, and some of them probably didn't participate in that, but many probably did, because once you get a crowd the size of that crowd at the Capitol, once they've been agitated up by the president and other speakers, not just the president, and then once the more extreme among them commit that first act of crashing the gates and rushing the Capitol, you know, a mob mentality sets in and people do things they wouldn't have already done. And again, and I've spoken about this, you know, previously, there's a radicalization that takes place there of these people radicalizing right there almost in the moment to being willing to commit really one of the most heinous crimes against your country that you could commit. Now, I hope some of those people have now thought like, wow, I really overstepped it and haven't become more extreme in their views. But that was a toxic mix.
But what about the president himself? Could his statements and his tweets offer evidence of intent in a criminal investigation?
They absolutely do. You know, from everything from, you know, seeding all of the lies about the election, ballot boxes being stuffed, ballots being counted three times. I mean, he said that to Secretary of State Raffensperger just days before January 6th when he tried to coerce the Secretary of State to alter the results. Things like dead people voting in mass numbers. You know, these are just lies, right? He's putting these lies out. He's then encouraging people to come to Washington, D.C. on the 6th. And the 6th, remember, is not just any day. It is the day that by law, by the Electoral Count Act, the joint session of Congress is meeting to open up the electoral slates of the states and certify the vote. So it's an important date. He's urging them to come on that date using strange terminology, not like come and engage in a demonstration, but says it will be wild, right? And then in the January 4th speech down in Georgia, he again argued that this was a steal, that we couldn't let it happen. They wouldn't concede. January 6th that morning, the, you know, fight like hell, never give up, etc. I'm going to walk with you, which of course he didn't, down to the Capitol. So all of these do show intent. And I think if you actually also then temporally overlay these with what is then being said by the planners on social media that he maybe was consuming himself. Like, was he aware of some saying, it's time for civil war, right? We need to take over the Capitol. Was he aware of that either because he was consuming that social media himself or those other chats himself, or because he was briefed on it by law enforcement, as he certainly should have been? And if he's briefed on those things and then says fight like hell, that also shows a lot about his intent.
More from Mary McCord after a short break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Mary McCord. She's legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and visiting professor at law at Georgetown University Law Center. So the House of Representatives voted to indict. The Senate must vote to convict. When do you think the best time for the Senate to take up that issue would be?
So, you know, ideally, I think it would be almost immediately. I realize we're in a very strange time. We're in the middle of a transition. I even do understand Mitch McConnell's point of, you know, this should be run by the Democrats, and that's not going to happen until next Wednesday. But he's right that the Democrats are in control now, well, you know, marginally, but in control, and should be able to be the one directing how that trial is going to take place, which can have a serious impact, right? Because last year, you know, there were things that the Democrats wanted to do during the evidence they wanted to put on, things that they wanted to explore during the trial that they were not permitted to do. So it probably makes sense, and I give Mitch McConnell credit for this, to say this should wait until Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, is the one, you know, in charge of things, and they can develop their own rules for the trial. But I do think it needs to take place soon so that it's still, you know, fresh in people's heads. It's too often with time, people start to rationalize things and discount the significance of the moment. And sometimes that's good. You know, we need to move on with lives and we need to get past traumatic experiences, but nothing should take away what an incredible abuse of power and what an incredible undermining of democracy the president engaged in. And so this is a situation where I think more time will lead some Republican senators to say, oh, you know, it's over. We shouldn't worry about it anymore. So I think it needs to happen quickly. That said, I understand why the incoming administration doesn't want the first several weeks of their administration, the Senate, to be, you know, all day long, every day doing impeachment trials. So I think this notion of, can we do a little bit of both? That, I mean, it's kind of weird, but it makes sense to me.
So, as I understand it, the Senate Democrats would need 17 Republican senators to go along in order to convict. What would conviction actually mean?
Well, I think conviction would mean that at least under, you know, the 14th Amendment, Section 3, that the president would not be able to hold elected office again. And that's very important because there are at least some indications that he's going to be starting to campaign, you know, the day he walks out of the White House. And certainly there are some of his supporters who want to see that. And so that's, to me, personally, that's the most significant. It's besides just the accountability for it. I also think that it would be a way for the Senate to show on a bipartisan basis that this is condemnable conduct. You know, the evidence is there to convict on it. And if they don't do that, it really... and I get it, 17 votes may be hard. I mean, to my mind, this should be 100 to none. But if they don't get it, I fear for what that means about just partisan politics, because we've seen some of the Republican leadership really make, you know, important statements about how horrible that was. Lindsey Graham, even, as well as Mitch McConnell, leaders who on the day of the insurrection made powerful, powerful statements against the president's conduct. And they seem to recognize that the president incited it. So to then say, but we shouldn't impeach or we shouldn't convict, I don't understand that. How can it be condemnable on January 5th for all the reasons that they stated, but then not something that they should impeach on?
That's just partisan. Do I understand correctly that the president would also lose Secret Service protection? He would also lose all travel privileges, financed by the U.S. government. He would lose a whole host of privileges normally given to post-presidents.
Yeah, I don't know how much that means to this president. I mean, this is a president who has financial means and can actually...
But does he? And is he going to face that problem as well?
That's a perfect segue, right? Like currently he does, or we think, you know, he portrays that he does. But I do think, and it is a perfect segue, I think we're likely to see civil litigation in addition to some of the criminal, ongoing criminal investigations that, for example, the New York State Attorney General and New York City District Attorney are pursuing. And so there definitely are possibilities down the road for his financial situation to change pretty dramatically, in which case some of the loss of some of these privileges could play a much bigger part.
Mary, I want to ask you about preparations for the inauguration. Thus far, they've brought in some 15,000 to 20,000 members of the National Guard sleeping in the floor of the Capitol. Is that going to be enough?
I think it will be enough for the Capitol. I mean, the Capitol, I haven't driven down there in the last couple of days, but I understand from colleagues who live right there nearby that it is a fortress right now. I think it is heavily reinforced, which is really, really sad day for the country when that's what we have to do. I mean,
and
I remember
what
thinking...
What about the rest of the city?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. So the Capitol's a fortress. It's impenetrable to the extent that protesters come, what are they then going to do? So I am worried about the residents on Capitol Hill. I don't think they're the targets of this, but if demonstrators are frustrated, where will they turn? And so that's where I think that job of the coordination between all of our law enforcement entities, the ability for National Guardsmen to also back up MPD out on the streets and not just at the Capitol, all of these kind of things are I'm sure being coordinated right now.
What are the kinds of questions that investigators into this entire insurrection should be asking about the president's role in all of this? What will they be looking into?
Well, I think they will be looking into, again, you know, the timing of his statements in speeches and in tweets and in Facebook posts and how those match up with any knowledge he might have had through briefings or for things that he had seen himself about the potential for violence. I think they will also be looking into contacts that he himself had or his surrogates, so people like Rudy Giuliani, people like Cleta Mitchell and Sidney Powell, as well as his, you know, actual White House inner circle? Were they in contact with any of the people who were involved with the demonstration and the insurrection? I mean, certainly we know he has contact with people like Michael Flynn, who I believe spoke to the crowd either the day before or the day of. What are the nature of those contacts? And you know, was Michael Flynn involved with directly participating or organizing with any of the organizers? So these are all, you know, connections are what investigators always look for. Also, I'd say connection was with some of those incoming, you know, Congress people, or I shouldn't say just incoming, but Congress people who might have been involved with the tours that seem very unusual on the day before. Any directions potentially given to anyone in the Capitol Police or other law enforcement, you know, any messaging that might have come from the White House. We haven't heard anything about that yet, but that doesn't mean it hasn't happened. So I think those will all be things that that investigators should be looking into.
So what do you know? What kind of intelligence are you seeing? What kinds of threats are you seeing for the day of Joe Biden's inauguration?
So it's very interesting because I see a lot of parallels in this time frame with what we saw extremist groups doing right after the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. So on the day of that rally, the extremist groups, the white nationalists, the unlawful militias, they were like elated. They felt like they'd been very successful. They had come out of the virtual space into the physical space. And, you know, they were saying, we're coming back again and again. You know, last week on the day of, and you see it in the videos, and the next morning, the most extreme of them, they felt so successful, like they had breached the Capitol walls, they had, you know, delayed the vote significantly. But what happened back then and what is happening now is that in the ensuing days, as the universal condemnation comes raining down upon them from, you know, so many corners, you start to see some infighting, you start to see some disagreement with strategy, you start to see arrests being made, which makes them concerned about law enforcement. So what we are seeing now is very hard for law enforcement to predict how big the crowds will be next week. But what we're seeing now is some of the groups that were organizing for armed marches on all 50 capitals this Sunday, on January 17th, some of those are calling those off, saying that these are law enforcement traps, don't go. Some are calling them off, saying we are for peace, we want to distance ourselves with any violence, and if you go, that's going to be used by Democrats to take away your Second Amendment rights. Some are saying it's all a big Antifa plot. Others are doubling down and saying, if you guys aren't going to go, then, you know, some of us have got to stand up for these things. And we're seeing that same type of rhetoric about January 20th. So I think that right now it's very unclear how many will actually show up. I think I feel like it's unlikely to have the numbers, the mass that we saw last week. But I don't want, you know, we should plan for it. I think it's unlikely we're going to have that same massiveness. But I think those who do come may be the more extreme of the bunch, which is dangerous. And this is also a time, unfortunately, when there's frustration in a movement, when occasionally you will get those lone actors who do something even, you know, even worse. And so that's a really hard thing to prepare for.
So how is the inauguration itself going to take place?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it was a smart move of President-elect Biden to have Lisa Monaco designated to kind of oversee the inauguration planning. You know, she was a special assistant to the president for Homeland Security, a longtime prosecutor, had been chief of staff at the FBI for many years. So she's a really good person to make sure that all of the people who need to be talking to each other are talking to each other and planning for the best, you know, safest outcome. I mean, I think they have to really think seriously about where the oath will be taken. The last I heard, it's still planned to be on the West Portico, which is outdoors. That could change. I don't know. It's possible. I don't even have the latest. But, you know, we already are in a weird time because of COVID and couldn't have had the big crowds usual. Now I know there's fencing. The entire mall, I think, is going to be closed. So question, does it need to be outside at all? So, you know, it's unfortunate for the president-elect and vice president-elect that this is not going to have the normal pageantry. But it's important both for public health due to the pandemic and for public safety due to what happened last week.
What would your own preference be as far as swearing in?
I would be advising do it inside with a very small group of, you know, carefully vetted people and who have gone through magnetometers and the whole works.
Without the normal kinds of crowds, without the normal kinds of celebratory events, there are going to be no balls, no gatherings at all. Isn't it better to play it as safe as possible?
So, you know, I mean, people can have different views because people can say, well, isn't that just capitulating to those who want to be disruptive? And maybe if we didn't also have a pandemic, I'd be more sensitive to that. But I feel like there's two good reasons to do it much differently. One is, you know, we just can't have crowds. And even with masks on, it's still, you know, not optimum to have a lot of people in close proximity. Now, it's better outdoors than indoors, of course, but outdoors presents other public safety threats right now, given what happened last week. So, you know, to me, it's not about capitulating to those who want to be violent. It's about public health and public safety and being smart. And you know, if they decide to do it outside, I'm not here to point fingers and criticize. There's good reasons for both. And happily, DC doesn't have skyscrapers where you have the potential for as many, you know, snipers as in some cities. You know, the building terrain around the White House is such where law enforcement has a lot of options for being able to ensure that there is safety out on the West Portico. And so that's not crazy from a law enforcement public safety perspective. But, you know, like I said, inside, very small group of people, all who have been COVID tested, all who are masked, heavily vetted, you know, with a few media to video it so that everyone can watch safely at home on their television or on their smartphone. That would be my preference.
So, Mary, we assume Trump is leaving office. He won't be at the inauguration itself. He's already said that. Because he's off Twitter, off Facebook, what is that going to mean for the extremist groups who follow him? Do you think they'll dissipate? Do you think he'll find other ways to keep them engaged unless the Senate does vote to convict?
You know, I think that this is really a lot of crystal ball speculation. I do think a lot depends on him and whether he migrates to other platforms like some of the extremists have and start using them. Even so, those are platforms that don't have the popularity or ubiquity of something like Twitter. So he's never going to reach as many people as he has been able to reach for the past many years. So right then, I think you'll have a smaller audience. But I also think it's possible once he leaves the White House, he'll, you know, get tired of this and move to something else. I mean, he's a very in the moment kind of person, it seems like, and he may get much more interested in his golf courses, which he's never lost interest in, by the way. So I do think a lot depends on him in terms of whether his followers will stay as devoted. If he is still having a social media presence, there will be people following him. All of that said, these extremists are not going to go away, even if Donald Trump never puts out another social media post or never gives another speech. I mean, we have always had some level of unlawful militia activity and far-right extremism, and it kind of ebbs and flows depending on who's in the White House and what the issue of the day are. And now that the Democrats are going to control the White House and Congress, that's their new cause of the day, and they will probably also coalesce around Second Amendment and concerns that the Democrats will, you know, impose restrictions on their Second Amendment rights. So they will find another cause, particularly because of the Democratic control of the federal
Last
government.
Last question for you, Mary. Some have actually compared the violence that we've seen and perhaps are likely to see with that created by ISIS. Tell me your reaction to that.
So I've made a comparison that's maybe a little different, which is that the comparison I've made is in the means of sort of recruiting and radicalization, right? Really, you know, ISIS created, used also false narratives about the West and imperialism and oppression, et cetera, in order to attract people to their cause. Also, sometimes very soft techniques, like come to this utopia, you know, where we'll live under Sharia law. So they did this combination of hard and soft. They used social media prolifically, and they got people to, you know, adhere to their ideology, and some of those people radicalized to violence. And so that's where I see the similarities. So far, we're not seeing the same types of terrorist attacks, although I don't discount. I mean, we definitely have seen domestic terrorist attacks, very bad ones in the last several years, and they've often been tied in some ways to things that President Trump has said. But and I don't know what would have happened if the folks last week would have gotten their hands on one of the legislatures or Vice President Pence. I mean, probably they would have been shot before they could have done much harm. But I think some were intent on causing harm to individual people, which would have been, you know, obviously that's terrorism. But I think that the tactics are actually very similar in terms of recruitment to an ideology from which some will then radicalize to violence.
I have to ask one more thing, and that is how much of a white supremacy ideology is motivating this group?
I think that's the primary ideology motivating it. I mean, they will deny it, some of them, some embrace it, some will deny it, but they align themselves, you know, with white supremacist ideology. They align together with others. You know, there was a Confederate flag among the insurrectionists in the White House. There was an Auschwitz sweatshirt on one of the individuals. Now, not every single person who participated last week probably, you know, is a white supremacist, but they are so closely aligned, and the lines they draw between white supremacy and what their views are fall apart upon further scrutiny. So I do think it's a core central principle. Maybe they would say they're not white supremacists, they're just anti-immigrant. It's the same thing.
Do you have any last words you'd like to say to our audience?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of things. I think I really do hope that after the president leaves on the 21st, or really the 20th of January at noon, that there will be opportunities for people to start listening to each other, to get out of their echo chambers, and for us to address not only, you know, this extremism and the violence, but also address the underlying causes of it. Because, you know, we can do prosecutions and all that, but that's not going to change the underlying causes that drive people to subscribe to this ideology and to extremism. Just like, you know, it doesn't change the underlying causes that drove people to the ISIS ideology. That's something you've got to get to the heart at, and that's a very difficult problem.
Mary, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Diane.
That was Mary McCord. She's legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and visiting professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Please, everybody, stay well, stay safe, take care of yourself and those you love. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.